So when you come out from meditation, you please stretch your legs or scratch something that needs to be scratched. Those who need to go to the toilet, you know where the toilet is. Those who need to come in can come in. Those who want to go out, go out. And quite frankly, if you go to the toilet now and you feel you want to come back in afterwards, please, you don't disturb me. So, for tonight's talk, it's one of the reasons why I don't get disturbed. You know, if somebody comes in during the meditation and make a noise, it's nice that you try not to make that noise. Or go out and then come back in again after going to the toilet. One of the reasons why I don't get fazed at all is because as a monk, one of the things which you've trained to do is to learn through wisdom and kindness, learn how not to complain. And that's going to be the subject of my talk this evening. Why do people complain so much? And what are the dangers of complaining? I mention this because somebody was talking to me and say they watch a lot of news, they read a lot of magazines or newspapers, they talk to a lot of people, and so much stuff which they talk about is complaining. And why do people complain so much, even if you're sick? It's a waste of time complaining about it. That just makes the sickness worse. It's one of the reasons why one of the stories I often tell to you is that if ever you go and see the doctor, what should you say when you go and see the doctor? Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. There's nothing wrong with being sick. Why do people add this cultural shame on being sick? Why do you think that you've made some big mistake, you're sick again, and you should try so hard next time not to be sick? If you try to be healthy, that makes you sick. One of the reasons I'm healthy is because I don't even try to be healthy. It's true. Ajahn Brahm should do more exercise. Do I do much exercise, to be honest? Oh, that one, yeah. Do I go for walks or runs? Nah. Do I eat good food? I think so. Other people will complain. But no, sometimes the attitude of mind I've found is so powerful. And why do people complain? They make it worse when they're afraid of sickness. So what's one of the reasons why? Please tell your doctor there's something right with me again, I'm sick. It's the way the body responds, you know, to illnesses. And there's nothing wrong with being really sick and dying. That's one of the reasons. Look, honestly, don't keep telling me, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you should look after your health. We want to keep you around for a long time. That's selfish. I've taught enough, haven't I? I was asking someone earlier. I asked them, are you still working? They were a doctor. They were a doctor. Very good doctor, very kind. And they said, are you still working? And they said, no, I've retired a year ago. I said, how do you do that? He said, well, you just do it. You decide to do it. So, I hereby don't decide anything. Why retire when you're enjoying it? And that's one of the reasons just why you don't complain. Oh, look at that. The door suddenly opened. That must be a ghost. That's the wind. Yes, you hear that? Do you complain about ghosts? I love ghosts, they're really nice. Because they also They protect places. If you're kind to them, like any other being, the ghosts will be kind to you. They were kind to our Buddhist society many years ago. One of our, I'll just make this up as I go along, as you know. This was Mrs. Poon Sop Wong. She's not here, that wasn't her. But, you know, she died many years ago. But before she died, that she came to see me, she said, look, I know I'm going to die soon. You know, she was accurate. But I don't trust my husband, George. I think he's a fool. I know some wives are like that. George was fine, but she didn't trust him. So she said, Ajahn Brahm, I trust you. Would you please agree to do my funeral service for me? If you do my funeral service, organize it, pay for it, then at least I will know it'd be a good funeral service. And if you agree to that, I will bequeath, you know, half of my house, you know, because that I own it, so it's share the bequest from my husband to you, and then that will be able to pay for the funeral. And I've often told this story, as a monk, you can't do deals like that. You know, we're not financial wizards. So I just asked our treasurer at the time. So he had a look, how much a funeral costs, how much the Buddhist society will inherit from half the property. And they said, this is a good earner for the BSWA. So I agreed. And she died. We did a funeral service for them. And the Buddhist, the monastery, Bunyana Monastery, paid for it. But after the funeral was finished, you know, he never paid up. We asked him once, I asked him, said, now have you got the what's it called, the will or the trust or whatever it is? And he said, I can't find it. I think she was a bit right, that he was a bit sort of... But we never pushed him, so okay, whenever he turns up, fine. That's why, you know, we just... As Buddhists, now economically we're not that smart. Look at this place, you know, it's got no chandeliers, it's no gold. You know, you have to sit on the floor, poor things. But nevertheless, you know, it's like homely, it's good enough. So anyway, so a month afterwards, I think it was, maybe 6 weeks after she passed away, George, the husband, appeared at Bodhinyana Monastery first thing in the morning, about 7 a.m. He'd hardly ever been to the monastery before. And I asked him, what are you doing? Why you come here so early? And he said, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm. He came in a taxi. He couldn't drive himself. It must have cost a fortune. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, please take it, please take it. What is it? It's a will. I found it. And he was really scared. I've never seen anybody in my life, I don't think, since that time, who was so terrified. And I accepted the will. So thank you, thank you. I had to ask him what happened the night before. Middle of the night, his wife came as a ghost. George, George, you know where that will is. Get it now. Take it to Ajahn Brahm, right now. I felt so sorry for him. the poor fellow, he was worried out of his mind, so I accepted the will so I can give it to the treasurer and he can arrange all the details. But that's what happens. Sometimes ghosts are very pleasant to people who help them. So I don't worry about ghosts at all. But anyway, about complaining about ghosts or complaining about anything. Again, what happens is I've noticed we do live in a society which complains way too much. When we complain, we make so much busyness which is not necessary. One of the first times I was taught this was by a prisoner in jail. Because I used to go out to teach in jails. Even this evening, one of our monks, Venerable Radha, has gone to Karnak Prison Farm to teach a few of the inmates there about Buddhism and meditation. You know, whenever you go to teach somebody else, you also learn so much. And that's what I did. When I went to this jail, there was this incarnate, many years ago, maybe 35 years ago, this prisoner, he was an old Englishman. And he came up to me and said, "Can I have a private conversation with you?" I said, "Of course." And he said, "Ajahn Brahm," he said, "I've been put in jail for a crime I did not commit. I didn't do that robbery, but no one believed me. So I've been put in jail for it." How would you respond? When I heard that, I actually believed him. He said, "Look, I know many people would say that, but this is honest, it's true. I never did that burglary." And I thought, I knew that it's so hard to, you know, to get a lawyer if you're actually already in jail to help you, because all your money goes and you don't have even telephone calls. You can't just go and ring somebody up. You don't have any mobile phones. So I said to him, I started thinking, I knew a few lawyers. They would do pro bono help for someone who's been put in jail for something they never did. When I was thinking, this old prisoner, he smiled at me. I recognized that type of smile as really being cheeky. And he said, "Ajahn Brahm, it's true I never did that crime, but never mind. There were so many other burglaries I did where I wasn't caught. I guess this is fair." He was teaching me the law of karma. How many times do you complain when you break the speed limit and you get caught? Is it worth complaining? How many times you break the speed limit and you're not caught? You get away with it. You're kind of lucky. So a lot of times what we complain about, we're just focusing on something just to be negative. You know, negativity gives you a certain type of energy, aliveness. You know, sometimes I've seen, used to see that some people, whether they're politicians or they are religious people, they get up here and they say, "Kill this person, kill that person, kill the others, whatever it is. Let's down with this, down with that. You know, this is not allowable, this is not good." That type of speech is gross. I never liked that at all. I never liked it when they said this person should be put in jail, this person should be thrown out. Too much complaining makes us so negative. I learned how to oppose that negativity just because somebody told me, again, this really wonderful story about when I first went to Serpentine to build Bodhinyana Monastery. I was very happy of, you know, when I gave a talk at the Cancer Association a couple of weeks ago, the guy who sold us the land, the real estate agent, Charles Orlando, he was there sitting right in front of me at the Cancer Society. So we, you know, we started talking about all the wonderful old times. And because he was sitting in front of me, we started talking about, you know, many old memories of what actually happened, what I had to do. We really were poor. We were in debt buying the land. And we had lots of interest-free loans. You know, people were kind enough, "Well, just, you know, when you get the money, just pay us no interest." So we were in debt when we started. We had no place to stay there. There's no buildings. And people didn't trust us. We were just two Buddhist monks at the time, myself and Ajahn Jacaro. Why give donations? You don't know what we were doing. And so we had to earn people's trust. And one way of doing that is to be very frugal. I learned how to build the first building myself. Many of you can maybe remember that. The first building was the ablution block, the toilet block. We did that to impress the council. Because they were saying, as long as you've got a proper place to go to the loo, then we make sure that there's going to be no health problems at all. Any health problems, then we really are in big trouble. So decided to make a building for the toilet block out of brick. What did I do before I was a Buddhist monk? Was I a laborer? Was I a builder? I was a theoretical physicist. It's the last thing from anything practical. But I thought you can lay bricks easy enough. And the story was, I think many of you know this story, but I'm saying it again because it's a beautiful story. When I laid my first brick wall, I was a perfectionist. When you are a perfectionist, that's where complaints come from. Nothing is good enough. So I laid my first brick wall, and there were... took a long time with every brick to make it perfect, as you would. And when I finished the wall, I looked at those two bricks, which were crooked. To this day, I don't know how I missed them. But they were crooked. They spoiled the whole wall. You know, for years, I couldn't find those two crooked bricks. Now, Venerable Metaji, you can find them in the monk's ablution block on the wall just to the right of the sinks. I lost them because what happened next? First of all, I was negative. I was complaining to myself. You know, stupid monk, you could do better than that. I tried to get the mortar out, could not do it. Tried to ask the other monk with me, can we afford some dynamite? Had to blow it up so I can start again, so no one would ever be able to see it. I wouldn't mind just working day and night, just putting it all together again, but I didn't want anyone to see my mistakes. We couldn't afford it. Can we get a bulldozer, push it over? No. But eventually, I was stuck with it. I had dreams about it. Nightmares. Wake up in the middle of the night, stupid monk. Until one day someone saw that wall and they said, what a beautiful wall that was. I couldn't believe them. It was like a shock. Have you left your spectacles in the car? Can't you see the two crooked bricks? There's only two of them there, right next to each other. Can't you see the two crooked bricks? And what they said next taught me about what complaints are and how to overcome them and have a more peaceful life. They said, yes, I can see the two crooked bricks, but I can also see the 998 perfect bricks. When I was in that fault-finding mind, that complaining mind, I could not see the perfect bricks. Your eyes went straight to the faults. When you dreamt at night, you just dreamt about the faults. When you thought about it, you thought about the faults. You just could not see the perfect bricks in that wall. That's why I started complaining. I wanted to blow it up. And I say that story, I've said that story many times. I'm going to Hong Kong early tomorrow morning. Some years ago, they invited me to the Chinese University in Sha Tin. And the reason was because they had lots of students committing suicide. And that's the story I told. And apparently it worked. You know, many of those students, the suicide rate went down. I said, why? I wanted to blow up a wall, destroy it, because I saw two faults. How many kids see a couple of faults and they focus on that, that's all they see. You can understand why you want to blow it up. You can't stand it any longer. But once you see things in balance, you say, yes, I've been put in jail for something I didn't do, but I did many other burglaries where I wasn't caught. I guess this is fair. You don't ask for perfection. You just see the big picture. It's okay to be sick. There's nothing wrong with being sick. There's nothing wrong with being wrong. How many times have you made a mistake in the last week? Is there anyone here who hasn't made a mistake in the last week? I made a couple of mistakes. You know, one of the mistakes, I haven't told a story for years. I'm pretty sure you didn't hear this last week because somebody just reminded me of it. When Ajahn Chacko left and I took over as the boss monk of Serpentine Monastery, I really needed to make sure it was a very impressive monastery. So I wanted to make sure I stamped out all laziness and lack of mindfulness. So when I was walking around the grounds, you know what I saw? Some idiot monk had left out a hammer. It had been in the grass, you know, for maybe days, because you could see it getting rusty. And I know those days, we didn't have much funds. One of you, now this layperson, out of faith, out of kindness, brought the hammer for us and offered it to us to help us do the work, and some idiot left it out in the rain as if it was not worth anything. And I thought, that's just not on. So I called a meeting of the monks. And at that meeting of the monks, you know, do you always say I'm really soft and kind? Actually, I learned from that experience. But I wasn't soft and kind that day. I said, listen, this is just not good enough. If the lay people, whoever it was, who maybe had to save up to buy that hammer and just did it out of kindness, out of faith, if they saw how you made use of that hammer, just left it out as if it, you know, didn't care about it at all, that is just not the sort of thing I want to see in a monastery, a monk's monastery, a nun's monastery, or any monastery. We're supposed to be respectful and grateful for all those kindnesses which you give us, not just leave it out to get rusty. And I really laid it on hard because all those monks, they were all sitting up dead straight, not like you, just bent over all over the place. Dead straight. And I asked them, honestly, I said, which one was it? Who did that? And that disappointed me that not one of those monks confessed. It kind of disappointed me. I thought I'd done it too hard. I should not be so fearful or, you know, creating fear. And I walked out of that hall really disappointed. And when I walked out disappointed, I thought, why doesn't anyone confess? And then I realized why. I turned around, walked back in the hall, and said, please sit down for a moment, to all the monks, only a few monks in those days. And I said, I need to apologize to you. As I walked out, I remembered who left that hammer out. It was me. And I'd forgotten totally all about it. Have you ever done that? You did something and you shouted at all the other people, why did you do that? And you realize that was me. Those mistakes are wonderful because I learned so much from that. You know, you learned how to not complain so much. I make mistakes, other people make mistakes. And that means you can have much more peace in this world. Why is it when people make a mistake, they do something wrong, why is it they can't forgive them? That doesn't make sense to me. I know some of the monks in Bodhinyana Monastery say I'm too soft. I'm sorry, that's what I am. There was one time, and I had to mention this to someone, they say, well, I did a mistake, you know, why don't you punish me? And so I said, we don't do that, not even in Buddhism. That was one thing which I really was inspired by when you read the Vinaya. There was no punishments, not at all, no matter what you did. And I thought, this is weird. So anyway, when this guy came up to me, he was an anagarika, you know, wearing white. And he said, what he had done, he said, the night before he was very hungry. You know, we can't eat in the evening. He was very hungry and he snuck into the kitchen at midnight or early hours, made himself a sandwich and ate it. He broke the precepts. And he said he hadn't slept all night since then. He felt so guilty. He felt, you're going to throw me out of monastery, aren't you? I said, of course not. Instead, I said, thank you for telling me. And number two, I said, look, there's all this other stuff you can eat. You know, the cheese, honey, fruit juice. I mean, if you see some of the stuff which, you know, you can eat on retreats, sometimes you think, you know, who needs a meal with all that stuff that you can eat? But, you know, you only eat it if you need to. And so I said, this is all you can eat. You know, also eat some more at lunchtime. And store it up a bit. And then afterwards he said to me, aren't you going to punish me? I said, no. He said, I need to be punished. If you don't punish me, I'll do the same thing again. So I told him, okay, I will punish you, Australian style. I will give you, personally, 30 strokes of the cat. You know what the cat is? It's this horrendous whip people used to use in the olden days. And I remember this fellow's face. He went white. And his lips started to quiver. He really thought I was going to flog him. Then I told him what 30 strokes of the cat are in a Buddhist monastery. You know what they are? We had two or three cats at that time. Find one of them. And one of them was Kit Kat, a very well-known cat. Find one of them, put them on your lap. One, two. Learn some compassion and kindness. So that's what we do when you make a mistake and you feel guilty. You feel guilty because you don't know compassion. You might think you know about kindness, but it's not strong enough. And so when you add that kindness and compassion, then that heals the problem. You realize you're a human being, you make mistakes, you're learning. And that's actually how we grow. You're not afraid of the mistakes anymore. You don't hide them. There's nothing wrong with being sick. When you don't stigmatize sickness, you can actually do something to heal it, find out why it happened and make sure it doesn't sort of happen again. When you feel guilty about it, that stops the healing and the progress. And that's one of the reasons why the Buddha would always say, you acknowledge mistakes, you're truthful, forgive them, and that's how you learn and grow. And that's a beautiful sort of saying of the Buddha. But it also means we don't complain about others, especially about yourself. One of the reasons people's meditation doesn't take off is because they see problems in their meditation. They complain to themselves about it. They complain to me and I think, for goodness sake, your meditation isn't that bad. Still remember this guy who came up to me once and said he's having a terrible retreat. He can only get into the first jhana, he can't get into the second. This is crazy stuff. If you know what the jhanas are, there's deep meditation, you're blissing out. Just one jhana is more than good enough. But when you have a complaining mind, you always want. So, what would you like? How much do you need to have contentment? You know, sometimes I remember, just because I came from a place like UK, that's where I grew up, and sometimes see some of these old places people used to live. So cold, so windy, so nothing much was there. And now these days, even just a simple one-room apartment is much more comfortable than some of the places where I grew up in. Much warmer, safer, but a lot of times it's not enough, we want more. There's a kind of complaining. We don't know the secret of satisfaction and happiness and peace. And we always want more and more and more. We have to keep working harder and harder and harder, and destroying the environment more and more and more. What are we doing this for? Now, every brick has to be clay from somewhere dug up and baked, and that's a huge carbon cost. Concrete also huge carbon cost. Why do we have to keep doing these things? Bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, I look at, say, the place where I live in a cave. It's more than good enough. You have contentment then. You don't want any more. And that's when I meditate. You sit down, the body is reasonably peaceful. It's not perfect. The mind is reasonably peaceful. It's not perfect. It's good enough. When I stop complaining, then I can enjoy my meditation. I can enjoy how it feels. There's freedom from always wanting more. There's freedom from always having to make it better, more peaceful. All of you in relationships, is your partner perfect enough? They could improve, couldn't they? But if you keep thinking like that, you can't enjoy your relationship. The other person feels it. Pressure's on them to improve. Why don't you improve? I thought about it first. You improve first, then I'll improve. Have all sorts of arguments. So instead of actually wanting people to be different, if you look at a person as they are, look at your meditation as you are, they are, we get to this point of it's good enough. This good enough idea. You think that's copping out, isn't it? You've got to go for perfection. If you're going to get these deep meditations, these jhanas and enlightenment stuff, isn't that making things perfect? No! These things arise because of contentment. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Is that perfection? Actually, that's how perfection is generated, by making peace with things. Make peace with your partner. Be kind to them. Be gentle to them. You'll have this amazing relationship. It's one of the reasons why, I think I said last week, that opening the door of your heart story, when I was in the book, when I got to the Bangkok, the Australian Embassy in Bangkok, there's four couples. Two were divorced, two were separated, trial separation. Because of that, opening the door of your heart and the two bad bricks, they came together again. I couldn't believe that. Being divorced, they decided to come back again. They realized why they got married in the first place. And that was more important than the two bad bricks in the wall. They could open the door of their heart to each other again. And this was two who had been divorced and two who were separated. They came together again. And because of that, and they were working in the same place, four of the four couples, that's why they sent an air ticket for me to go to Bangkok. Arrived in the post, just an air ticket. Please don't do that, because I get into trouble. What am I going to do with this one? It's in my name. But nevertheless, I was very honored and touched that they were showing respect, you know, for having solved a big problem in people's lives. I remember sometimes talking to little kids, you know, how they felt when their mummy and daddy separated. And they said it was really terrible for them, because sometimes they argue with their daddy, they got no mummy to hug and kiss. And sometimes they argue with their mummy, and they got no daddy to actually cuddle them on their lap while Ajahn Brahm is giving a talk. It's really important. They got two. So anyway, that's what the kid told me once, you know, from their heart. So anyway, it's wonderful when we don't complain. When we complain, we're not looking at the negativity. But sometimes many of you may be thinking, but Ajahn Brahm, you have to complain sometimes. You may be a manager in an office and somebody's coming in always late, they can't do the work, you know, they're causing trouble, and that means the business might go bust. That's one of the reasons why I hope you remember this story, which I taught in going to all these amazing conferences and in human resources. I was asked to give this session over in Singapore when I happened to be there, a lecture on Buddhism and human resources, people management. And then from there, I got this invitation to give a similar talk in London at a big international human resources conference, paying the tickets. You know, it was business class and also a nice hotel, and I was allowed to actually go and visit family afterwards. All paid for. Good opportunity. So I did give the talk there, and afterwards when I came back to Perth, I got another invitation from the National Health Service in UK. They said, they attended my talk, they liked it. Can you please come back to London? Actually, their conference was being held in Birmingham. Can you please come to Birmingham in UK to give the same talk for the National Health Service? And I replied to them, I said, listen, you're the National Health Service, you should know better. I've just did an international tour, a long flight all the way from London back to Perth, and now you want me to come back again? That's bad for my health. And you're the National Health Service? The lady who invited me wrote this lovely letter back saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. That's on my desk, it cheers me up. Instead of complaining, you made me laugh, it made me happy. That's the other way. You find you get so much more benefits when you don't complain, but you make it funny. Or when you praise. You know, there was one thing which I taught there, was what we call the sandwich method. If you're in meditation, if you're in management, and you have to tell somebody off, how do you do that? What you do, have you ever been told off at work or as a student? A university, or as a young monk, being told off. And sometimes people think, this is really unfair. I work my butt off for this company, and this is all they give me, just criticism and criticism and criticism. Can you relate to that? So instead, the sandwich method is, whenever you want to criticize somebody, start praising them first. Saying all the wonderful things they've done for the company. Yeah, I know you always come in late, but you're such a nice person, you know, when you actually get to work, whenever that is. You make it up, but be kind. Have you ever noticed when people praise you, you start to listen? It's a way of opening up people's ears. And once their ears open up and open up and open up, then when it's open enough, they're waiting to hear the next praise, and then you hit them. Not physically. That's where you give the criticism. And once you get that criticism, you actually hear it. How many times you try to tell somebody, look, we're here for you. What is the problem? Why do you get late to work? You know, can we get another schedule for you, or just get someone else working in this office who can pick you up or whatever? Why? Is it problems with your family? Can we help out there? Do you want a few days off? Why? When actually you are kind to them, they do open up. They do start hearing. So often when people criticize one another, they just don't hear it. And more criticism, I get this from my partner at home. I don't want anything from my boss. But anyhow, you give that criticism. But you must always finish with praise. But you know, you're such a good worker, I'm sure we can work out some solution to this. Why don't we, you know, get some counseling for you? Or, you know, we can actually take a day off or a few weeks off, or let's change things around a bit. That means the person, the boss, the one who's doing the criticizing, is actually being kind. You know, kindness is such a rare thing in this world, such a valuable commodity. If you realize that the person who's your boss, your mentor, your supervisor, your abbot, your spiritual dictator, if you realize they actually are kind, you can actually take that criticism. It doesn't hurt so much. You never go back being negative. Why do they say these things to me? Don't they know the pressure I'm under? And that means the complaint or the criticism is accepted and heard. That's why we call it the sandwich method. Layer of bread, criticism, another layer of bread inside. So this is actually just how, and if you do that to your meditation, how is your meditation? Is it working? Are you critical of your meditation? How about seeing its benefits first? The wonderful things that meditation has taught you already. The peace and the stillness which have actually happened. And then you say, but yeah, I should do it more. Don't stop there. Yeah, I should do it more. But you know, life is very difficult. I'm sure I'll be able to manage it somehow, rather this way or that way. Maybe, as I often say, if you don't meditate enough, get a place in your house. You know, your meditation room, a meditation corner, a place in your office, some place. It doesn't take much place to meditate. Look how much this, and I'm fat. Look, it doesn't take that much space. You put that little cushion in the corner of your bedroom, if you've got a bedroom, or in the corner of your one-room apartment. That's all you need. Put a couple of Buddha statues or photos somewhere and only use it for meditation. You've got a place. This is what I mean by never being negative. What they usually say, what I always remember, always rather light a candle than complain about darkness. An old Chinese proverb. Too many people complain, 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 complain. The government's corrupt, the police force doesn't work, the Buddhist society is not comfortable enough, we should do more things. You know, the Ajahn Brahm tells the same stories and jokes every week. Remember the people who haven't heard those jokes. The ones who actually laugh when I say these stories. Even some of the monks, sometimes they tell me that, you know, some of these stories, I assume they know them, but I tell them over here, I don't tell them in the monastery. And so they really appreciate these things. Because actually they do change people's lives. Even that story of the two bad bricks, four couples, they came together again. In that peace and harmony, and the kids, you know, had mummy and daddies. That's an amazing thing you could do. and all those little stories which actually help people, that's wonderful. So that's one of the reasons why, don't complain. Instead we listen to these things and we realize, yeah, sometimes we're just too demanding. Of, you know, we want it this way, we don't want it another way. The complaining mind. Instead of that, have this delighting mind. You know, one of the qualities we very rarely talk about is a quality of mudita. Mudita is where we rejoice in other people's happiness and success. We find happiness as somebody else hears a story and it works for them. Wow! Somebody else got a nice meditation. Somebody else, you know, they got this wonderful success in their career. Don't ever feel jealous about it. You're wasting the opportunity of rejoicing in other people's success and happiness. That's one thing which I also love about Buddhism. If you ever come to any of these big alms offerings, especially the Sri Lankan community are the best in this. You may get some wealthy person, this was in the time of the Buddha, they get a nice robe, and a king or something, offering a robe to the Sangha. He doesn't just come in here and offer the robe. He shares it with everybody, invites you to rejoice in this offering. He paid for it. But when you rejoice, you get an equal share of the karmic result, the good karma. You rejoice so much in the happiness of this that you get uplifted. I remember experiencing that when I was at Perth Airport many years ago, waiting for a monk to arrive. But instead of the monk arriving, who came out of the terminal first with his group of Baha'is? They'd been refugees for about 1 or 2 years, and now they managed to get resettlement here in Perth, about 30 years ago, I think. And as they came out of the immigration, through the doors into Perth Airport, they'd been through so much suffering, many of them didn't make it. They were killed or tortured. When they actually came through those doors, they were punching the air. Yeah, freedom! We've actually made it into a safe country, yay! And as about 6 or 7 of these came out, the first 6 or 7, when the next few came out, I found myself punching the air as well. Yay! The happiness was infectious. Why not? Why can't we enjoy the happiness of others, the good happiness of others, and also join in the celebration? I wasn't a Baha'i, I was a Buddhist. I didn't even know these people. But still, why not join in the celebration? Instead of always being critical, we actually enjoy other people's success, the success in the world. And after a while you can start to see more success. Yeah, this Buddhist society, we're going to have an AGM soon. And at the AGM we always think what we can do next. But sometimes before we feel about what we're going to do next, what have we done already? And sometimes somebody came to our monastery today, I haven't seen her in years, an old member from the very earliest days, Jenny Ma. And she was just looking around and saying, wow, you know, when I first came here, sometimes you monks didn't get enough food. I mean, really. It's just wonderful to see how much has grown here. Now we've even got nuns as well, fully ordained nuns. We've got this beautiful places, not just here, but many other parts of Western Australia. And what a wonderful thing has happened here. She never felt, you know, that the room was too cold or too hot. She just was rejoicing in what had been achieved already. And that reminded me of just, why do we so critical? Complaining about our lives. How much has been achieved already and attained? It makes us actually another way of getting this beautiful satisfaction and peace in our lives. And we use that with our meditation too. Just how our meditation can really be appreciated. And that happiness is the key to taking it deeper. When I said, just when I'm relaxed, I have happiness. Because I realize just how wonderful it is at my age to feel so much peace in my body. And I look at my mind, how wonderful it is to get this taste of peace in one's meditation. And when you get very deep, how wonderful it is to get these incredible states of mind. And they really are incredible. I said this to the monks on Wednesday, I'm just going to repeat this to you now. I usually do this on the deep meditation retreats. Even just getting into these amazing meditations, the first jhana, the way the Buddha described that, he said we call that the experience of Sambodhi Sukha. Sambodhi means enlightenment. It is literally means a taste of enlightenment pleasure. And you can do that. Do you really want to know what enlightenment feels like? For yourself, you can do that. You don't have to believe me. You don't have to read about it in a book or see it in a magazine. You can experience that. Some people do. It's pretty spooky, freaky, amazing, but true. So that is actually how we can have so much happiness and joy. We don't complain, we appreciate instead. Okay, I've talked enough. So let's get some questions and answers first. So, thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. You know, when I first started doing those three big sadhus, people complained. What are you complaining about? It's good energy. Okay, question from Germany. Okay, well, this is a nice way of putting it. Tonight there were greeting and compliments from USA, Canada, Bangkok, Australia, Sweden, Germany, Bolivia, Spain, Scotland, Korea, North Korea or South Korea? India and Myanmar. Thank you. I should actually say, we're talking about this just online, that there's a couple of people, only a small group, they are translating these talks actually as they are spoken into Ukrainian and also into Russian, because they notice how much difficulty there is in those lands right now. And it's a waste of time just doing it in Ukrainian to Russian as well. And they're doing this, all these talks, even this talk I imagine they're doing as well, to make these available as much as possible. So these little talks are not just, you know, for people here solving problems in war-torn lands. Anyway, from Wolfgang Gabby, question from Germany, how can you be happy when the world is burning? It's not always burning. There's places which aren't burning. I feel ashamed being human. I am afraid that I lose my kindness and turn it into anger. What do I do? To stop anger and not kindness. What you do is you look at not just the two bad bricks, look at the beautiful bricks in this world, the wonderful places where people are living in harmony together, the places which are not at war, the places which are doing something, just like this talk here being streamed over to Ukraine and to Russia. It's a wonderful thing which is happening. That's actually to remember the goodness. Rather light a candle than complain about the darkness. Complain about the world burning. Light a candle is perhaps not the best simile. But nevertheless, you know what it means. Richard from Bolivia. What are the asavas or outflowings of the mind? I know they are kamasava, bhavasava and vichasava. Could you give some practical examples of each one of them, please? There's only supposed to be questions in 5 minutes. That's a huge one. Kamasava is actually, you know, for the sensory world, the delight, trying to avoid suffering, safety in this physical world of the five senses, is what takes you out. Why does the mind, when you're meditating, why does it go out for these things? Why does it search for these things? It's after a while, when those things get kind of softened and pacified, there's nothing really why you should go out from this present moment, from this silence and this peace, why to go out anywhere. Bhavasava, that is the outflowing caused by the wanting to be, to exist. It's like if you're very still, things start to disappear and vanish. The state of existence which you really were used to is vanishing. It's much more peaceful, more blissful, but still a bit scary. The simile is I usually use, like the prisoner's been in jail for 50 years and now is offered release. It's scary going out of a place of suffering like a prison, but you got used to it. Going out into freedom is a bit too much. That's like a bhavasava. And ivijasava, that's of delusion. Sometimes people prefer to be deluded. You know that sometimes that people are really, really sick and they die, and sometimes they feel, oh, they haven't really died yet, they'll be back. The delusion is one way of dealing with, you know, what we think is intolerable suffering. No, my husband isn't dead, he's just sleeping. So that's how we just ask, you go out because of delusion. It's much more important to be truthful. Even you think it hurts at first, but actually it hurts much less than being deluded. Now, Devmin Subhasinghe, I think I must be from India. My meditation has been going well, but as a student with important exams in the horizon, I often find it difficult to let go and calm the mind. How do you manage during your time at Cambridge? It was easy. It was so helpful for me. I told the story many times. And I taught the same at Carmel School here in Perth some years ago, because I knew the chaplain there. He was a good mate of mine, Moshe Bernstein. When I gave the how to pass exams easily, it was because the students weren't doing well. And afterwards, I should have kept this letter, because it was a letter from the principal of Carmel School. He said, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for coming to teach our students, year 12s that year. We came top of the list of schools for the year 12s. It actually worked. You know, they weren't supposed to do that well, but they became the best top school in the whole of Perth. So how you do that, first of all, sitting down, let go of the morning exam, let go of the afternoon exam in the middle of the day, letting go of past and future. And that means I could be aware of my body, which was actually shaking. It was high stress. My whole life depended upon it, so I was told, these final exams. My life would not depend upon it. I'd become a monk. I didn't need those exams, but nevertheless, I never knew that at the time. So, came into this present moment, no, I was shaking. How can you be of full energy if you're shaking like that out of nerves? Once I calmed my body down, as I taught you how to calm your body down at the beginning of the guided meditation, the next thing, look at how peaceful I was. When I started looking at my mind, it was not peaceful, it was exhausted. 3 hours of quantum physics exam in the morning. Pushing yourself to the limit. Of course you were tired. But one thing which I realized with meditation, it energizes your brain. It's like you're a mobile phone whose batteries is almost dead. And after meditation, you come out of that meditation with fully powered up. So that's how I did things, and it worked. Lavelle Esther, question from Australia. If this body is not me, mine, it seems as though one could quite as easily experience life as an animal, etc. Is this the right view? Do we all start in lower realm? Maybe, but it doesn't matter where you start. You're right now in the higher realm of being a human being, but to actually to investigate it. You don't believe these things. You don't just trust them. This body is not me, not mine, not a self. You learn how to explore that truth and see its consequences. And it's wonderful when you're just a visitor to this body. So if things kind of go difficult for you for a while, it's not your body. You're only a visitor. Care for it, but don't own it. Don't be attached to it. Gloria. How to handle family members who probably are too afraid to deal with their suppressed emotions and as a result is very well walled off. If they've really got suppressed emotions, make sure you don't have them yourself. Make peace with them. Be kind. Be gentle. How do you deal with prisoners in jail who've got huge amounts of trauma? You're kind to them. And as you're kind to them, when they trust you, they will reveal all of their secrets to you. That's why we wall off to other people, because we're afraid if they knew the truth, we'd be in big trouble. When you realize, you know, the only trouble you will have is to find a cat and stroke it 30 or 50 times. You're not afraid of truth, even if it's embarrassing. Okay. That's five questions. Oh, six, seven? Please, only four questions usually. But last week I never did any questions because of the monster came in, the lion dance. Anyway, I'll do this too quickly. What do you do to help a compulsive liar? Someone who can't help but habitually lie. I want to be able to tell them what to do. They feel guilty and want to stop. Your help appreciated. Please let them know there's no punishment. That telling the truth is more beneficial, happy, healthy, free than telling lies. So they will tell you a few things they've done. And when you do it, say, oh, well done. Give them a gift for telling the truth, even if it's embarrassing for them. In other words, it is encouragement, because we're always... If we tell the truth and it's something we're embarrassed by, you know, some people always get punished. And that just hides the truth. We're a compulsive liar only because we want to protect ourselves. Quickly, question from Canada. I'm new to Buddhism. Where should I begin? What's the first thing I should know and do? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. You've already done the first thing. You've listened to this talk. Well done. Carry on listening and keep asking questions. And that's good. Don't think there's a beginning where you have to start. Start anywhere and let it grow. Where's the best place to plant a flower? Just throw a few seeds out there and see where it takes off. Eventually look after that flower and it grows almost by itself. Your job is to protect the flower. Make sure that nothing destroys it. It soon grows all by itself. That's how you grow a child. Protect him, make sure good influence, and it soon grows. And listen to talks like this, because that's one of the other reasons I chose this subject of non-complaining. If you live with other people who complain all the time, always negative, that infects you. You become negative too. You're around positive people, always forgiving and kind and gentle. You become that too. The attitudes of speech and mind are infectious. You find you come here, good people, hang around, tell jokes, kind to one another, you feel safe here. You go home feeling so much more at peace. Okay, questions from the floor. Okay, questions from the chairs. complaints, Eddie.
Surprise. Ajahn Brahm, good talk, man, Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, don't you think, you know, our problems, you know, arise and stay with us because we give it that identity, you know? Identity? Okay? Yeah, there's like a, we're attached, we grasp to the problem, the thing, you know. We should learn to let go, you know. And, you know, yeah. And perhaps we can see it more clearly if we refer to the Buddha's three characteristics of existence. He was telling us, first is no self. Second is, impermanence. Second is no self. Third is suffering, okay? So the thing is, okay, normally, okay, like for us, no, it's the situation is flat. We have no problem, no. Then something arise, okay, arise, and then we give it an identity, you know, okay? And then not realizing that things are impermanent, you know, we grasp at it, you know. We grasp at it. During the grasping, the suffering is a stress. We feel stressful, you know. So if we can sort of know this thing, okay, learn to let go, and then apply all these equanimity things, let it go down, this thing, you know.
Yes.
If you can see, we need to practice.
Yes.
Because a lot of our problem, we look out, it's outwards, and we don't look inwards, you know.
Yes. One of the problems is when you talk about identity.
Mm.
I call that identity fraud. I don't own anything. If you feel you do, that's called identity fraud.
Mm.
Isn't it wonderful if you feel... There's lots of service I give to this place, to other places. Mm. This evening, I need to get back to my room pretty early because tomorrow morning, early on, I'm flying off to Hong Kong. I don't own any of these places.
Mm.
That's called identity fraud. I'm not sick, my body is sick.
Mm.
If I feel sick, that's identity fraud. Get the understanding?
Yeah.
We make a self where one is not necessary. Mm. Anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie. So, I will never complain about your questions. So please, none of you do either. Otherwise, I'll complain about you complaining. Okay, thank you for listening. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Next week, Ajahn Brahmadi will be here. He'll be here tomorrow as well for the meditation class. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. So now we can just pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.